From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm David Watts Barton. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has just ruled on two and perhaps three issues revolving around the 2008 voter-approved initiative known as Proposition 8. In a moment, we'll have a discussion with people who have been following the case from different sides. But first, we have Marianne Russ to explain to us a little bit of what the court ruled. And Marianne, we just found out, this just came out from the Associated Press. What have we heard so far?
Yes, David, it is evolving. We're still gathering the information. But what we know so far is that that federal appeals court has declared California's same-sex marriage ban to be unconstitutional. Now, what this does is it paves the way for a likely U.S. Supreme Court showdown on the voter-approved law. The three-judge panel of the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco ruled 2-1 this morning that the lower court judge interpreted the U.S. Constitution correctly back in 2010 when he declared the ban, of course known as Proposition 8. He declared it to be a violation of the civil rights of gays and lesbians, and today that federal appeals court agreed. The measure, which passed with 52% of the vote back in 2008, outlawed same-sex unions just 5 months after they became legal in the state. Now, the lawyers for Proposition 8 sponsors and for the two couples who have sued to overturn the ban have both said they'll appeal to the Supreme Court if they didn't get the ruling they wanted from the Ninth Circuit, so we definitely can expect that to be the next step in this process.
Well, thanks. We'll keep an eye on that, and we'll have more later in the day. Thanks, Marianne.
Thank you.
We have two people now in the studio, or one in studio and one on the phone, to discuss this. Matt McReynolds is of the Pacific Justice Institute, a conservative group that was heavily involved in the case that was just decided. Hello, Matt.
Good morning.
And also here in the studio is Lawrence Levine, who is a professor of law at McGeorge School of Law.
Hello. Nice to be here.
Lawrence Levine, how likely is this to go to the Supreme Court? In the story, it said that this seemed like it was going to go to the Supreme Court, but I think that
might be a bit of a premature to assume that. The appeal can be brought, but the Supreme Court gets to choose which cases it hears. And while there's a lot of attention and indeed even controversy about the issue, it depends very much on how the opinion is written, how broad it is. And the Supreme Court may choose to hear it, but they very well may elect not to.
Mm-hmm. And when you say broad or narrowly written, how what do you mean?
To the extent, and since I haven't had a chance to see the opinion, I don't know its breadth yet, but to the extent that there is a California-centric focus to the opinion, and it really talks about Prop 8, it may be less appealing to the Supreme Court of the United States to take up the issue in this case. If it's a broad pronouncement that the United States Constitution prohibits banning gays and lesbians from access to marriage, then I think the court may have greater interest in weighing in on the issue.
And does the state Supreme Court have an equal protection clause as well?
It does, but this case was decided under the U.S. Constitution. Under the state constitution, the state Supreme Court had already struck down the ban against that limited marriage to heterosexuals.
Okay. Matt McReynolds of Pacific Justice Institute, what's your take on the likelihood that this is going to go to the Supreme Court?
I think it's pretty likely. I think it would be, I like the professor, I haven't had a chance to get through the what I understand to be about 128 pages worth of the opinion and dissent in the last 5 to 10 minutes. But so there's a lot there. There's going to be a lot that we're going to be digesting over the next few hours. But I would be surprised if it were a limited decision. I'd be surprised if it's not something that stretches beyond California and really would be applicable in all jurisdictions of the Ninth Circuit, which, you know, if you think about it, you're talking about from Arizona to Alaska, out to Hawaii and over to Montana, quite a number of states implicated here that do not have same-sex marriage legalized either.
Mm-hmm. Or have actually moved to prevent it from becoming legal.
Correct.
Your group was pretty heavily involved in this case that was just decided. Is that correct?
That's right. We've been involved actually for more than a dozen years, stretching back to Prop 22, which was the first voter enactment on this issue back in 2000.
Okay. And in this case, going back to 2000?
That's right. Prop 22 was enacted by the voters in 2000. It said the exact same thing as what Proposition 8 said. Mm-hmm. As the professor was just mentioning, the Cal Supreme Court struck that down, and then Proposition 8 fixed the problem, so to speak, under California law by elevating its language to the status of a constitutional amendment and not just a state law.
Now, obviously, the results of this ruling have been awaited by more than journalists and legal experts. It's also affects an awful lot of people in the population one way or the other. And we have our own Steve Milne downtown at a bar downtown. And he is, I guess there's a gathering down there of the anti-Prop 8 people. Correct, Steve?
Yeah, David. Yeah, I'm here. I'm at the Cornerstone Diner in Midtown Sacramento. About 100 people here, and I'd say about 30 of them are here for the announcement today. And very jubilant, as you can imagine, the mood here. I've got a couple here, Ellen Pontac and Shelley Bales. They're a Davis couple. They've been together for 38 years, married in 2008. And here's Ellen to talk about what she's feeling right now. Mm-hmm.
Hi, this is Ellen, and I'm almost too happy to talk. It's just, it's here we go again. I mean, Prop 8 has been overturned several times, and we're just excited and happy and ready, really, to have this over with.
Okay.
We took a picture of some of us older folk because we really want to have this happen in our lifetime.
Okay, well, good luck with that. Steve, you got somebody else there to talk to?
I have my wife Shelley is here. Would you like to have her on?
Sure.
It's a good one.
Hello, Shelley.
Hi, this is Shelley.
Hi.
Go ahead. Sorry.
Go ahead. How are you feeling right now?
Okay. Well, actually, I feel really, really happy, overjoyed. We've been doing this for a very, very long time, fighting this discrimination, and I can see the finish line. I am so happy we are going to cross the finish line in our lifetime. I know it. I feel it in my bones.
Okay. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Hello?
Steve?
Yeah, I'm here.
All right. Thanks so much.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, David.
Okay. Take care.
Bye.
Matt McReynolds, obviously, we have some people who are very happy about the decision, and you could find probably just as many people who are unhappy about it right now. Where do you see the finish line at this point? Because this can go back and forth. It has gone back and forth, as you pointed out, for 12 years or probably longer. Where do you see this going?
Sure. Well, we hope that ultimately the finish line is determined by the voters and not just by a few guys in black robes. So, this issue could play out for a long, long time. I think the Supreme Court is going to address it in the very near future. Besides this Prop 8 decision that all of us have been watching out here on the West Coast, there's a very significant litigation on the opposite side of the country in the First Circuit based in Boston over the Federal Defense of Marriage Act. And that's at the appellate stage, likely to be appealed one way or another to the U.S. Supreme Court, later this year, next year, when the ruling comes out. So one way or another, I think it will reach the Supreme Court in the near future. There are a few different ways that could happen, but I think it'll end up there, and I think they will either resolve it one direction with gay marriage being mandated for all states, or they'll continue to allow it on a state-by-state decision level, in which case it's going to be playing out for a long time.
And would your group be comfortable with the state-by-state, if that's how it ended up being? Some states get to have gay marriage and some states don't. Would your group be okay with that, or would you still be trying to push against gay marriage anywhere?
Absolutely. If Proposition 8 had been rejected by the voters here in California, you wouldn't find myself or my organization trying to bring some kind of a lawsuit to say that the voters were wrong. The voters had to have it the other way. And we're not going to be doing that in other states either. If the voters genuinely want to expand the traditional definition of marriage, then we think that's the voter's right to do that. What we don't think is right is for it to be imposed by the judiciary.
That's Matt McReynolds of the Pacific Justice Institute. We're talking about the ruling that just came from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals about Proposition 8. They ruled that Proposition 8 is unconstitutional under the Equal Protection Clause, we think. That's approximately. Nobody's really had a chance to read this yet. Larry Levine from McGeorge School of Law. If this goes to the Supreme Court, we have a Supreme Court that is very different from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. It's three times as many people. And it's not based in California. It's based in Washington, D.C., and it has a much more conservative bent to it, right?
Somewhat more, but let me back up a couple steps. First, there's probably an intermediate step that we could predict, which is one can petition the Ninth Circuit for a hearing en banc, which means a larger group, as many as 11 judges, hear the case. And because this generates so much interest, it would not surprise me that that request will be made and granted. And so it's a long process. I know Ellen and others who have spoken say they can see the finish line, and I think they're right that we're going to see changes growing in the definition of marriage more and more over the next few years. Because even if we put these issues to a popular referendum, which I think is peculiar to do when we're dealing with civil rights issues, the writing on the wall suggests that even the popular sentiment is to support marriage equality and not prevent gays and lesbians to have access to marriage. But I think along the way to the Supreme Court on this case, there's a very good chance that a larger body of the Ninth Circuit will chime in. And the Ninth Circuit has conservative judges and moderate judges and progressive judges. In fact, this panel was made up of a judge who I think many people would think is quite liberal and one who's quite moderate and one who's rather conservative. Mm. And so it was a microcosm. It'll be interesting to see what the Ninth Circuit ultimately does if they do hear this en banc. And then it may, as I suggested, it may go to the Supreme Court, although I agree with Mr. McReynolds that there are enough issues brewing that one way or another, it's likely that this issue eventually will get to the U.S. Supreme Court. It may not be this case, mm-hmm. but the issue of the Defense of Marriage Act or marriage equality one way or another will probably get to the U.S. Supreme Court.
We also have some really different points of view on the whole process, because you were saying it's kind of an odd way to make civil rights laws to put it to a vote of the people. And Matt McReynolds is saying it's being decided by some people in black robes.
Exactly.
And the truth is it's decided by both, isn't it, Matt McReynolds?
Sure. To some extent, it can be.
And Larry Levine, how do you see that? Which is more important? I mean,
I think this is exactly the key issue, is the perspective one brings to the issue of whether this is something that should be put to a popular referendum, or is it something that is really a matter of civil rights, the Equal Protection Clause, due process. This is playing out in New Jersey right now. The Governor Christie said, let's have the people of New Jersey vote on the issue of marriage equality. Mm-hmm. And even though the polling suggests that most people in New Jersey would support expanding the definition of marriage, to use Mr. McReynolds' terms, that even though they would be support that, so it seems, according to the polling, I think there's a very strong argument that that's just the wrong way to do it. First of all, that the legislators are representatives of the people. They're elected by the people, and the legislature of New Jersey is on the precipice of supporting marriage equality in the state of New Jersey. Is something unsettling about the idea of the popular will defining a minority group's rights? Mm-hmm. And we've had a long history of not doing that.
Mm-hmm. Matt McReynolds, I'm going to give you the last word on this.
Yeah, a couple things. I would just say the debate really goes back to the debate we have over kind of an original understanding of the Constitution versus a very evolving understanding of the Constitution. And when we're talking about the Equal Protection Clause, the 14th Amendment, we're talking about something that was put in place in the wake of the Civil War, most specifically to protect former slaves. And so in the minds of folks who have kind of an original understanding of the Constitution, that's something that was never intended by the people who put it in place to apply in this kind of scenario. And so that's something that that they would take issue with, as well as the notion that the people of California, 7 million, more than 7 million people who voted in favor of Proposition 8, many of whom also supported President Obama for in his candidacy. The idea that all those people are somehow ignorant and intolerant, which is what they feel like the Ninth Circuit is saying to them, is just something that that really sticks under their skin.
All right. Well, Matt McReynolds, thanks so much for joining us. And Larry Levine also. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Insight is also online, and we do have a link to the ruling on our website from at capradio.org/insight. Coming up, a closer look at Nevada's Republican caucuses. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm David Watts Barton. We are well into primary season on the Republican side, and the contest is still not decided. But last week, Nevada had its caucuses, and Mitt Romney was the clear winner, which I think gives him 2 wins so far. But much has been written about Nevada's role in the primary season, and there's been considerable speculation about the future of the Republican Party in this once solidly conservative state. Here to discuss Nevada's caucuses, the state's struggling Republican Party, and the political future of the state is Eric Herzig. He is department chair and professor of political science at the University of Nevada in Reno. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So how important is Nevada's caucus in the overall caucus primary circuit? It's not a big state.
In terms of the nominating process, Nevada isn't that important. We have 28 delegates. We are a caucus, which is kind of an oddity in this process. But what happens in February has a lot of importance in the fall, and that's when Nevada becomes important. We are one of the true swing states out there. We voted for Bush twice, for Obama, for Clinton twice. And so, you know, unlike, say, California, which has far more electoral college votes but is pretty consistently in the Democratic column, or Texas, which is larger, which is pretty consistently in the Republican column, Nevada's important in the fall when we will be a swing state.
But during the caucuses, they got a lot of coverage this year. Why was that?
Well, because we were the only game being played, let's say, on that Saturday. And in terms of the caucus and the attention was focused on the Republican Party, first in the West. And the Republican Party, the state Republican Party in Nevada, just didn't do a very good job. Because it's a volunteer effort, it's not paid for by the state, the party runs it, and it varied in extreme from county to county in terms of how well it was run. In Washoe, say Reno, it ran very smoothly. But when you got down to Clark County, Las Vegas, they added an extra evening caucus, they didn't get the vote count right, and matter of fact, the vote count didn't become official until yesterday. That meant they missed the East Coast media deadlines. They really looked as if they weren't very well organized. Attendance was down. These are not good signs for the Republican Party going forward, getting ready to organize for that fall general election.
Mm-hmm. And is that partly a blowback from there have been several pretty controversial Republican politicians in Nevada in the last few years, John Ensign and Sharon Engel. What's been the result of their presence in the Republican Party there?
Well, you're right. I mean, part of it is the Republican Party has had some controversial candidates. They've also just not been very good at the organizational basics. They've had, I want to say, 5 state executive directors in the past 4 years, or 4 in the past 5 years, so it's not a lot of stability. And this is somewhat ironic because in 2002, the Nevada Republican Party was running on all cylinders, won every statewide office. The Democratic Party was in disarray. The Democrats, realizing this, got better organized. Harry Reid played a major role, kind of coming in and just becoming the so-called godfather of the Democratic Party, really influencing who ran, how they raised money. The Republicans, meanwhile, couldn't live on their success. This is when you start this kind of free fall into these intra-party fights. Who's a real Republican, and are you a conservative? And then, you know, the Tea Party emerges, and that just added, you know, fuel to the fire. Add in, you know, John Ensign, who was, in a sense, hey, he's our lead dog in the Republican Party. Then he falls by scandal. Jim Gibbons, who just wasn't a very good governor overall, and particularly not for the Republican Party image. And you've got a Republican Party that's got a lot of administrative damage control to do.
I'm speaking with Eric Herzig. He is the department chair and professor of political science at the University of Nevada in Reno. That's a lot of change in 10 years. How much of that had to do with the actual the change in Nevada in terms of the in-migration of a lot of people? The worst hit mortgage state in the country, right?
Oh yeah.
It was a huge boom. How much of the Republicans' problems are sort of rooted in that boom, do you think?
Well, I don't think their problems are rooted in the boom. In fact, with your intro, you said this formerly solidly conservative state. That's not true about Nevada. Nevada has always been a swing state. I will point out that Nevada holds, in a sense, the national distinction of we have voted for the winner in every presidential election since 1912, with the exception of 1976. No state is, in a sense, a better bellwether for the presidential race. In part, that's because our parties haven't been especially strong. The Democrats, but they were very conservative Democrats, dominated from, say, 32 to about 1990. The Republican Party reemerges then, and it's a more conservative party. A lot of people moving from California came to Nevada because we don't have income tax. They were, in a sense, fleeing kind of the liberal image of California. Mm-hmm. This boosts the Republican Party. But at the same time, it brought in factions within the Republican Party. So the growth at first fuels the growth, expansion of the Republicans, helps them electorally, but over time, the cracks emerge, and that's where the Republican Party is now. At a bad economy, our unemployment rate's the worst in the nation, our foreclosure rate's the worst in the nation, our drop in personal income is the worst in the nation, and you add all that together, and the Republicans are struggling to find some unity and find an answer that the general public in Nevada is going to buy.
And is that what do you think that answer is going to be for the Republicans after this caucus? Is it Mitt Romney?
Well, Mitt Romney won the caucus, and Romney is fairly popular in Nevada. He still suffers a little bit from the bland factor. I mean, I went to the caucuses, and you know, people were voting for Romney. It was not like, oh, I just love this guy. It wasn't the enthusiasm that, say, a Barack Obama engenders. But mm-hmm. Romney's never going to get to that level. Mm-hmm. But if the party can rally behind Mitt Romney, he could run very well in Nevada. He gets a Mormon vote boost. He's a business-oriented Republican rather than a social issue-oriented Republican, and that Nevada is far more about business issues than social issues. Hmm. So Romney could bring it together. We have a fairly popular Republican governor who could also kind of play a role helping recruiting candidates and bringing people together. But the on-the-ground kind of people who knock on your doors and, you know, help get the flyers out, whatnot, that's where the Nevada Republican Party has really been stumbling for about the past, you know, say, easily 5 years.
Okay. Well, it'll be interesting to see where we go from here. Colorado's caucus is today, so that should add some interesting fuel to the conversation as well.
Absolutely. And, again, Romney is on a pretty good roll right now, big win in Florida. Expected win in Nevada, but he won solidly, better than 2-1 over Gingrich. Mm. Colorado is also good ground for Mitt Romney. Romney has a good February lineup of caucus and primary states. Gingrich, I think, will hold on to make a kind of last stand in Super Tuesday with the southern primaries because that's his base.
All right. Well, we'll be watching. We won't be watching Nevada for a while, but maybe in November you'll hit your 100th anniversary of being right on the presidential election.
I think we will be in the national spotlight because, again, we're one of the few states that's, in a sense, up for grabs, and that any party, depending on their organization, depending on the quality of candidates, and, of course, depending on, you know, how the issues play out, we should be in play.
All right. Well, thanks so much. Eric Hirsig is the department chair and professor of political science at the University of Nevada in Reno. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. Coming up, Belva Davis reflects on her decades in the news business. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. I'm David Watts Barton. Now it's time to find out what's happening in the news today with senior editor Alan Ray. He joins us from the newsroom. Hey, Alan.
Well, good morning, David. Sacramento Mayor Kevin Johnson holds his weekly news conference this morning, and he wants to talk about his plan for something called Bank on Sacramento. It's part of a successful Bank on California initiative started back in 2008 to help Californians open a bank account and start saving for the future. What he may not want to talk about so much is the warning that came in last Friday from the United Nations Human Rights Council, reminding him that the city isn't providing safe drinking water and sanitation to its homeless. That's the sort of reminder usually sent to third world countries. Also making news and waves this afternoon will be the Ninth Circuit Court ruling upholding the lower court finding that California's ban on same-sex marriage is unconstitutional. And there's word the Obama administration may change its course on the matter of contraceptive coverage for people who work at Catholic hospitals. Those stories and more beginning at 3:30 this afternoon on All Things Considered from Capital Public Radio.
Thanks, Alan.
My pleasure.
My next guest is said to have been the first black female TV journalist west of the Mississippi, and she is the winner of awards for her reporting on the AIDS epidemic and other subjects. Now she's the author of a book on her life, and she is in Sacramento this week for a book signing. Her name is Belva Davis. Her book is called Never in My Wildest Dreams, and she is in our studio. Welcome.
Oh, I'm so delighted to be here. Lovely studio, incidentally.
Oh, thank you. Finish this sentence for me. Never in my wildest dreams.
Would I have been on stage Sunday with Anna Deavere Smith?
Where was that?
Grace Cathedral with the dean, who is also a woman, Dean Jane Shaw. What a life experience, right?
And why would that never have occurred in your wildest dreams?
Well, when you look at my background, and that was the revealing news in the book, was telling people where I came from and my beginnings, because when I started, I thought that people should pay attention to what I was reporting, not what had happened in my life that may particularly have swayed me to one viewpoint or the other. Mm-hmm. So I kept my life story pretty much to itself, but... I'm a very fortunate person that has been touched by grace so many times in life that I managed to get that job in television without any training in television and without a college degree and without, you know, all of the things they say that you need in order to be successful. You know, I was born to a single mom, young, 15, given away. Raised by relatives, bounced around from place to place, never without love, but always with insecurity, who had to learn to sort of take care of herself. And there could have been no better training for life, certainly life in television, than learning to take care of yourself.
And your job in television started, where did you start?
I started at KPIX, which was then the leading station in TV news gathering. Back in 1967, I went on the air. They hired me the latter part of 66. I went on the air in 67. And fortunately for me, you can count the years, but I've worked steadily in the Bay Area for one station or the other since then. And add to that I'd had a life in black media before that, where I had been the women's editor of a black weekly paper, a reporter on that, and on black radio. And I still think that was the grandest time of my life. I worked for KDIA, Lucky 13, and played jazz and did interviews and had a wonderful time.
So when you start KPIX, you had a lot of experience in media. It was just all in black media.
Yes. And that didn't count in those days. That was not counted as experience.
And how did you get the job on KPIX, which was not black media?
Pure luck. There was a woman named Nancy Clark Reynolds, who became a aide to Governor Reagan, who adored the Reagans and had said in an interview to a newswoman on the woman's side that if Reagan is ever elected governor, that I would really love to work for him. And so the day after he was elected, assuredly, I called the program director and said I wanted to apply for her job. And he was so enraged because he'd never heard of this. And I said, where did you find out about it? I said, well, it was in the newspaper. Anyway, long story goes on. A couple of weeks go by. They find out she really wants to leave. And then they put out an open call. And, you know, and working on radio had was helpful. I mean, that gave me at least some sense of how to use my voice.
Okay.
Which, incidentally, is not here today because I have a very bad cold.
You have a bad cold. Okay, noted. But you were also breaking a color barrier of sorts there, too. Were there any African-American men at KPIX when you started?
Dear, wonderful guy named Ben Williams. He had been the first black hired for a major newspaper, The Examiner, back then. Stolen away from The Examiner by Westinghouse. He'd been there about 6 months when I got there. Mm-hmm. And he became my guardian angel as we both, you know, found our way, as he said. We were just thrown in there with no training and says, sink or swim.
Speaking with Belva Davis, her new book is called Never in My Wildest Dreams, and it's about her life and her career. What was your first day like at work?
Just trying to learn the language of the moment and knowing that I would have to make friends. Because when I got my first assignment was to go out and do a stand-up, I didn't know what a stand-up was. Mm. And so I got outside and I said to the photographer, what is it that I'm supposed to do? What is a stand-up? Mm-hmm. And so my whole challenge of the first days wasn't the gathering of the news. It was the relationship with people that I had to work with. I'm going into a male-dominated world, going into that as a woman of color. When I go out with my technicians, I'm a mixed couple, which now we're talking about Prop 8. You know, it was just not really, really very acceptable to see mixed-race couples, even in the late mid-60s.
You were in a mixed-race couple?
But no, because when we walked out, they were all white, of course, because
okay.
The media.
Right.
So anybody that worked with me, if we were walking down the street together, we became a mixed-race couple.
Gotcha.
And some guys just always found a reason not to walk down the street with me.
And in 1967, which is when you started, was the year that the anti-miscegenation laws were overthrown in California.
Yes. Yeah.
So when you were going out on assignments and working it within the newsroom, was it harder being a black person or harder being a woman in terms of the response that you got from people? Or did you see it as being hard? I mean, was it?
I just saw them as two challenges that I had to accomplish because there was nothing I could do about the fact of the matter. I'm a woman. I'm a woman of color. So I had to learn to work on both of them. The experiences of life as a black in America leave an imprint on you because it's meant to, that you have to always fight against. And that is, you have to continue to say to yourself positively, I can do this. No matter what some social scientists say, I have it within me to do it. I just have to work maybe a bit harder at it.
Mm-hmm.
And being a woman in some places, on the social side, you know, you're not invited. Back then, all newspaper people felt it an obligation to go to the bar. Mm. Smoking and drinking were like the last two requirements for being a good reporter. And so, you know, breaking into that kind of a social scene was difficult.
I'm speaking with Belva Davis, and we should say also that she's going to be at the CSUS Library Gallery reception today at 3 o'clock, and then on Thursday at 5:30 at the California Museum downtown.
Yeah.
You covered a lot of news in your time.
Mm-hmm.
What's some of the biggest stories that you covered? You were around for Jonestown. You were around for the Summer of Love in San Francisco. There was a lot. The Black Panthers. There was a lot going on.
An awful lot going on. So it's very hard to enumerate what it was. I spent an awful lot of time on Berkeley's campus, a lot of time on Sproul Plaza.
Student
had a lot
protests.
Of experience with protests. Mm-hmm. Great deal of experience with learning how to survive tear gas of various sorts. And an awful lot of experience trying to prove that even though that I'm only 5'1", I have the nerve to stand up to whatever is coming my way, whether it was from a student or from a sheriff's deputy. So those are the things. But, you know, I was lucky enough to have not only covered the stories of California, but it was one of the first, just behind Barbara Walters, a reporter to be granted interviews in Cuba after the long 15, 16-year silence of Fidel Castro. Later on, I was fortunate enough that as a local reporter, I was the one American team sent over after the bombing of our embassies in Kenya and Tanzania to report on the plight of the thousands of Africans who had been injured as a result of the bombing of our embassies, and to make some pleadings for those people, and to accompany a doctor, a wonderful woman, Romana Tosco, who bought supplies to them to aid them at that time. Those were big stories on the big front. At home, you know, there was the whole relationship with the Black Panther Party, being involved with when I got to Cuba, meeting Huey Newton there, recording an interview with him that led to his return. Being from another angle, contacted by Aldrich when he was ready to come home, and being instrumental in getting him to making it possible, comfortable for him to return home. Those were two singular things. And I guess my final thing was working to just explore and make people aware of a guy named Bob Wells, who had been in the California prison system for 47 years. He was the state's longest-term prisoner, and he'd gone to prison initially for stealing a suit of clothes. But one incident after the other, some of it his fault, he was there that many years later. It was the warden of San Quentin who turned me on to the story, helped me to get the interview. But Bobby eventually was freed and died a free man, even though not a very good life, because he didn't know anybody.
When you were covering things like the Black Panthers and the student protests and Castro and Eldridge Cleaver and Huey Newton and all these very controversial people, did you find that with your editors and the people that you worked with, did you find that you were considered to be, because you were Black, that you had an access that people wouldn't have? Or did you have a little suspicion that you might be on that side, or that you wouldn't be able to be an impartial journalist?
Well, I only had one argument over where my relationship seemed to come into play. And that was when Eldridge Cleaver came home, and he revealed what the Panthers thought was the actions of the government, intelligence, and the manipulation of facts in this project that was later called COINTEL. And he complained about J. Edgar Hoover and made these charges against the government. And my station did not want to air it. But I worked in a very liberal newsroom. The chief anchors and others in the room stood with me. That's when I knew that that was a wonderful, wonderful moment for me. We aired it, and it turned out he was right. So.
And you've retired from broadcasting?
Nope.
Nope?
Nope.
You're still working?
I, my dear, am in public television.
Oh, okay. I did not know that.
I do. I anchor a program at KQED. It's on Friday nights, and it's called This Week in Northern California. And I've been doing that for about 18 years. And it's the joy of my life, and I'm still doing it, which I soon will depart from, I hope, because they've been there a very long time.
I was going to say, when you get around to writing your life story, it's...
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Well, thanks so much for coming in.
It's great talking to you, David.
Belva Davis, her book is called Never in My Wildest Dreams, and she's going to be today at the CSUS Library Gallery Reception at 3 o'clock, and then Thursday evening at 5:30 at the California Museum. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
You're listening to Insight from Capital Public Radio. We'll be right back. The Camingo and it is being played by my next guest. Her name is Ginny Kim, and she is a master of the Korean instrument called the kamingo. She composes on it, and she has even gone a bit further. She has electrified it. She's going to be playing a little music for us in a few minutes, but first I wanted to welcome her to Insight.
Oh, thank you so much.
It is such an interesting sound. I'm trying to think of what it parallels other instruments. So
that's right. It's kind of one kind of instruments in the world. So I don't know how to say. If people know about Indian sitar, and if they know Japanese koto or Chinese qin, maybe those combination of that. Because mine has the frets, 16 frets and 6 silk strings. And it's about 6 feet long. And I play with the bamboo stick. It's very exotic. And I know not many people had seen this instrument.
So I guess like a kora, because a kora is played with a little hammer, like a hammer.
No, it's not a dulcimer. It's not a hammer dulcimer. It's bowled jitter.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it is bowled jitter, 6 feet long. And I put the instrument on my lap sometimes, yes. And I'm pretty sure some people saw the long, bold, jitter string instruments from Asia. You have to imagine, relate to that.
Yeah, and this instrument has been around since?
Fourth century,
yes. Okay.
Many Korean instruments come from China and then evolved into Korean instruments. However, this kamingo is a really indigenous Korean instrument.
Are there many indigenous Korean instruments?
Well, there are some other about 60 different kinds of instruments, but those are all originally came from China and then it's evolved into Korean instrument. But kamingo is known as a real Korean indigenous instrument.
And how long have you been playing it?
Too long. Well, let's see, now about 40 years, I guess. Yeah.
40 years.
I think so.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. Well, actually, let's listen to a little bit. You recorded a few minutes ago, you recorded live in the studio with your acoustic, right?
Right.
Let's listen to that. And the name of the song is?
Morning Song for CPR.
All right. This is special for us. Thank you. That's Jenny Kim playing the kamango,
yes,
a traditional instrument from Korea. She will be performing tonight a solo composition called Digital Buddha at Capistrano Hall at Sac State. Is it hard to get resonance from the instrument?
If you look at the instruments, it looks like a big boat. Mm-hmm. It has a very good soundboard. Mm-hmm. Every instrument has soundboard. Because the size of the instrument is big, then you get really nice sound out mm-hmm. of it. Yeah. By the way, this instrument is known as a male instrument.
Mm.
Yeah. In Korea, this instrument was performed by the male Confucian scholars for their own meditation. And so when I heard that story, I challenged myself that why not?
Uh-huh.
And so I started to, playing this instrument as a female. And it's been very interesting. And, of course, right now, many young women, the players playing these instruments. And because the instrument was based on the Buddhism aesthetics, so music tend to be very meditative.
Mm-hmm.
So tonight I'm playing music entitled Digital Buddha. In a way, it's kind of 21st century multimedia meditation.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm going to do, I'm using two instruments, acoustic, and then also the world's only one electric kamango. That kamango is hooked up with a computer program with a MIDI pedal.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm playing two instruments. And then also I have a projection, video projection about I would call video mandala. So I will set the stage as a really meditative stage.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can imagine from this morning, the sound you just hear, and it gives you very calm energy.
Mm-hmm.
And then it'll build a more spacious sound. What I mean by that is that when you use electric instruments, the sound quality is very different from acoustic.
Yes, yes.
And it stretches the time sense. It's really timelessly. So that's what I'm going to do tonight.
And that's why I asked you about the resonance, because with electricity, you can get fake resonance. You can get all kinds of effects off of just one note. How far do you go with that in terms of manipulating the sound?
Oh, I think it's endless, because I'm constantly changing program every year. With the computer. And actually the reason I have electric kamango is not for the amplification. You can make amplification with a good microphone.
Right, on an acoustic.
Yeah,
right.
But I wanted to have a second toy. So this is going to be a really different kind of sound compared to the original acoustic. And
in fact, go ahead. We want to play just a tiny little bit. We do have a recording of the electric kamango.
How nice.
Got a little, it sounds like digital delay on that.
Yes, it's a digital delay. Nowadays you can buy digital delay, all those things in prepackaged one. But if I adapt all the sound, then sounds like electric guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want to make my instruments like electric guitar. So I manipulate all the program, change the program. So then it's a manipulated digital delay, I would say.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, it sounds great, and it's not. It does not sound like a guitar. It still sounds like a kamango.
Exactly.
All
yes.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, thanks so much for coming in.
Oh, thank you so much. I hope that people come to concert.
Yeah, Jenny Kim is going to be performing tonight at Capistrano Hall at 8:00, and her performance is part of the Sac State's World Music Series. Thanks so much for coming in. And we could also look on our Facebook page, Insight on Capital Public Radio, and it will you'll be able to see a little snippet of Jenny Kim performing Digital Buddha. And that's Insight for today. I'm David Watts Barton. Insight's assistant producers are James Morrison and Lynn Weaver. Our associate producers were Sarah Jung and Sosa Morar. Our technical director is Mark Jones. And Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. Thank you for joining us.